For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
All right, guys, welcome back to Pulse to the Wall. And tonight, James Jeniman is making his Pulse to the Wall debut, which it's a huge honor for him. I'll just say that for him. So, James, how are you doing tonight?
Hey, doing great. Honored, humbled even to be on your show, Nick.
Excellent. And for the listeners, Tyler's out tonight, and Mike is trying to put his army of babies to sleep. And I told James before we started that they're trying to stage an insurrection and overthrow their current bedtime rules.
I saw one of them with their feet up on their mom's desk. It was insane.
Yeah, we're going to be making a registry. But okay, so tonight we were talking about like what topics to go over on the podcast, and there are a couple that stuck out to me. And one has been this recent, I'll say this is under the umbrella of sort of the post-libertarian arguments that have kind of emerged the last couple months, it seems like, really picking up a lot of steam. And I would say that I'm completely like open-minded to it. And we talked a little bit before the stream that there's a lot of like talking. I mean, it's a lot of orating to try to distill like some very vague ideas. Like it's tough to understand like exactly what the argument is, right? Like there's plenty of critiques without much of an alternative offered. So I thought we could talk about that. So what has been your exposure to a lot of those conversations and podcasts that have been going on?
Yeah. So, I have actually been listening a lot to Andrew from Popular Liberty just because he's going to be on my show, here in the next couple of weeks. So I've been really trying to get a grasp on what he has to say. You know, and in addition to that, I'm listening to whatever everybody's talking about. Like when Clint had Cyprian and Erickson on, I've listened to that. I've listened to a few postmortems of that. and I don't know. Is the audience like familiar with what I'm talking about?
Yes, I think so. Yeah. I think we're trying to talk today about what our niche is, and we've had some like big name guests on, like I shouldn't say big name, but you know, we've had like the Lions of Liberty on, we've had Dr. Stephen Hicks on the podcast. So we've had all of these like sort of public intellectuals that are like very kind of blue check mark types. And then we've also had like, you know, the guys from Not a Podcast and Timeline Earth. So yes. I said that we are the bridge between like the libertarian public intellectuals and the underworld of shit posters. Like we are where they connect. So, I think our listeners have been paying attention to a lot of that stuff. And, I mean, just a little backdrop, what makes it interesting to me and what I think is unfortunate is when these sort of like personal attacks get made where, I mean, let's zoom out about what the Mises Caucus is. Mm-hmm. You know, it's no small feat what they're attempting. Like they're attempting to change the course of the political conversations in our country, thus changing the politics and taking on the military industrial complex and the central banks and all of this stuff. I mean, when you look at it, it's really a huge undertaking. Like this is no small goal that they're attempting.
Yeah.
And to me, it's like, if you're going to make, like, I think that the more people that you can red pill, the better, like, you know, the more numbers we have, the better with actually changing policy. And to me, I guess the most compelling argument I'd heard against it, where it's like, okay, I'll hear you out, is that, you know, this is going to be a cutthroat political business that is like, you need to be Machiavellian to do this. And when you look at the LPMC, it's consisting of like very good, well-read, honest, friendly people. And it's like just the structure of that, it makes you skeptical. Like, okay, are they equipped to do this? And I'm open to the idea that they can. I think the steel man for the LPMC is that you get enough people and that just organically puts pressure on the machine to change policy. So what do you think about like that general framework?
Well, let me ask you what you think the purpose of the Libertarian Party is.
So I've recently been swayed by the sort of Tho Bishop, Eric Brakey argument that the GOP is actually the best vehicle to get our policies across. And I think if you look at Ron Paul, Rand Paul, Thomas Massey, Justin Amash briefly, those sorts of people are the ones that are actually getting elected. And even they are super, they're very few in numbers.
Yep.
So the idea that we're going to elect libertarian politicians, it's like, okay, that's not going to happen. The vast majority of the public does not pay attention to the news and the different political, you know, inside baseball conversations in this country. They just go in the voting box and they click R or D and they move on with their lives. So they're never going to check the L box. So the Libertarian Party does not exist to elect libertarian politicians. It's really a messaging vehicle. So, you know, how effective can that messaging be if you're not winning any elections? And I don't think that you necessarily need it to get your messaging across. I mean, again, Ron Paul was a Republican and he's the origin story of like, you know, 90% of the people in the LPMC.
Yeah.
So, I mean, but you know, again, steelmanning the LPMC, it's like, well, we have this thing that people have heard of. So why not take it over and get the message across? So I guess that's kind of where I stand. How about you?
Yeah. So if you like read David Nolan's essay, even before he founded the LP, he wrote an article called the case for a libertarian political party. And he makes it pretty clear in that his purpose and the purpose of any third party is not to get elected. It's to hold the politicians' feet to the fire. And I see that as a potential purpose of the LP and especially the Mises Caucus. I think that the local strategy is the way to go if we're going to be running candidates. And I think that we should be, in addition to, you know, running a presidential candidate, just to get somebody on TV. Other than that, I think the only purpose of running statewide candidates is to spoil a terrible Republican versus a terrible Democrat. You know, I mean, in a lot of states, including the one where I live, Minnesota, running a statewide candidate is how you get ballot access. So, you know, run somebody for attorney general or comptroller or something like that. If you've got a half decent Republican running for governor and a terrible Democrat running for governor, don't spoil that race. I mean,
yes. Yeah.
The 2020 tells us what governors can do. It's fucked up, you know?
Right. I mean, right. and people will, you know, people went after Gary Johnson and Joe Jorgensen for like swaying the entire outcome of the election. Like, oh, they split the vote. Like Trump could have won these counties if Jorgensen wasn't there. And it's like with 1% of the vote. No, I'm sorry. Yeah. That's not going to cut it.
Well, however, and until we have like a Curtis Yarvin Machiavellian president in the White House, it's not going to matter who's president anyway.
Exactly. And that's what I love when I try to talk to normies, which I want to get to this. I think that the ultimate goal here is to sway the normies. Like the normies make up the majority of this country. Yeah. And the question is, how do we get those people who are politically apathetic that don't care to pay attention and vote for good politicians to push good policy? Mm-hmm. So I think that is like the big question. I got sidetracked again. What was I talking about before? Or what did you say? What did you end on?
It doesn't matter who's president.
Oh yeah. Really. Right. Right. So when you talk to them, it's like, well, look at what Trump actually did as president, the policies he had. It's not very substantively different than W or Obama or even Biden now. I mean, it was just very different rhetoric in the culture war, but you're not actually changing policy that actually matters when you go to like, you know, pay for your health insurance premiums or go to the supermarket and pay different prices for produce.
So not to get super dark and black pilled, but I mean, you know, the worse the president, the faster the demise. I mean,
I mean, I'm also open to the accelerationist argument. Sure. You know, not that I cheer it on. I think a lot of libertarians gleefully look forward to like hyperinflation, and it's like, guys, that's not something you should cheer on. It's like, if you think it's inevitable and you want to like prep yourself, then that's fine. But I wouldn't take any pleasure in that prospect. It seems pretty dark.
Hey, Mike.
Hey, James.
Hey, welcome to the show. Good to see you.
You too. Sorry, I just wrestled four kids to bed, so I'm a little scatterbrained. But that's awesome.
You're heroic for doing that.
You guys just chat a little bit, and I'm going to pick up where I can see a nice inlet for myself.
Cool. You've got all kinds of acoustic paneling. That's awesome.
Yeah.
I started using Podsworth Media for my audio editing, and the guy's giving me all these tips. He wants me to make DIY acoustic panels, though, and I've got a drill, but I don't know how to use it. So
I bought these on Amazon, but you know, it was a little pricey, but it worked very well. And I did it because I have a bunch of kids. I wanted to be able to record when they're awake once they're older. So anyhow.
I'm also building a little podcast pod in my basement. I'm actually going to make a video. Nice. It should be pretty cool. But a little tornado room. But okay. So we're going to get back on track.
Sorry, I got it sidetracked.
No, I do it too. So it's all good. I think the purpose of the LP, you know, it's okay. We're not electing libertarian politicians, or at least we have not.
not in big races. I mean, at the local level, there's, you know, I mean, maybe 100 or so elected libertarians. It's not a huge number, but it's nothing to sneeze at either. I mean, Kara Schultz, who is here local in the Twin Cities, she's like head of candidate recruiting for the LP, but she's also a city council member. And also she's gotten another libertarian elected to the same city council. The suburb, like right next to me, is majority libertarian on their city council.
Oh,
so,
really?
So those local races are real. They're winnable. The thing is, they're not partisan. You don't have someone with an R or a D or an L or whatever next to their name on the ballot. You just vote for who made the best case to you as a voter. In most cases.
Isn't that a better solution overall, though, just to go off of platform rather than letter next to the name?
Yeah, I think like, so.
I mean, like Nick said before, is that there's so many people that they vote like it's a sports team. Like I'm a Bear fan or a Packer fan lifelong.
And that's my dad. Like if you ask my dad, straight ticket voting is the best thing that ever happened to Texas. His ballot, he can fill two bubbles and that's it, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Which, I mean, if you listen to like the Tho Bishop sort of argument, it's compelling that, and this is where I've been kind of drifting more towards lately when it comes to actually like getting our policies through, is it's much easier to capitalize on the sort of populism that you're seeing within the GOP. Like they are ripe for change of course. Like the you know, Republican conservative voters of this country are not happy with the establishment. They're not fans of Mitch McConnell. They're not fans of all of the usual suspects. So there's a good chance that we could actually inject our ideas into those platforms and start swaying people that way. Yeah. So I'm completely open to that. And also like you were talking about the local elections. I know that Tho Bishop has basically taken over his local GOP in Florida. And like, that's awesome. And that's how you actually start fighting back. You nullify things at a small level. And that's where you can actually have influence. So, I mean, whether that's the Republicans or libertarians, I'm completely cool with that. The question is, you know, what is the best vehicle for doing that? But then the one post-libertarian thing that I've been grappling with lately, and I never thought this far ahead. And again, this is why I say it was unfortunate that it started getting into like this personal mudslinging thing is we're talking about, like I mentioned before, what the overall goals are of the Mises Caucus. And we're talking about like, you know, creating this discontent for the establishment, like for the cathedral. And that's a big thing. And the cathedral is going to fight back. And let's say somebody like Dave Smith does run for president in 2024, not somebody like Dave. Let's say Dave runs in 2024.
There's nobody like Dave.
Yeah, exactly. And I've been listening to Dave for 5 years. Like I love Dave. He introduced me, he radicalized me, all this stuff. But we know that the cathedral's immune system is going to kick in and there's going to be a targeted PR campaign against Dave and the Mises Caucus and everybody involved. And we've watched them do this over and over again with like the Proud Boys and January 6th and all these things. And the question is, like I mentioned, you know, the Mises Caucus is consisting of like well-read, nice, respectful, happy people. I don't know if everybody involved has thought that far ahead about what that response to a national campaign would look like. Is that a concern that you have?
Yeah, sure. Why not? I mean, it's Clint and Mark Claire were talking about it actually on a very recent, maybe this week, episode of Lions of Liberty.
We heard
that's a real threat. Yeah, for sure. I mean, especially when you've got what's his face, like lumping in libertarians with the MAGA folks as like the next big threat. The war on terror, I think we all knew this. I don't know. I came from the left. I've been opposed to the war on terror since 2001. So I know that people in my circles back then were predicting this war on terror is eventually going to be turned inward. I don't think the Daily Coast community back then thought it would be a Democrat president to do it. And I don't think they're opposed to it now. But we've kind of always seen it coming. And if libertarians are, especially Mises libertarians, are lumped in with QAnon and, you know, whoever else, then yeah, I think more and more of us are going to be on lists. More and more of us are going to have our phones tapped and our travel restricted and that kind of thing. It's a very real threat for sure.
Yeah. And I think that,
and it's something to consider when we're doing our political activities. There is no shame. And, you know, I mentioned Curtis Yarvin earlier. There is no shame in sitting out, even going the agorist route and just, you know, fending for yourself.
Yeah, no, I completely respect that as well. I think that might ultimately be the best option. If you're an individual, if there's a strong argument to make that, you know, just seceding from the system and insulating yourself from all of the political happenings in the world is actually the most responsible thing to do for your family and for yourself. But at the same time, it's like, you know, I love an underdog. I like people fighting back. Like, I can't not cheer that on. So the idea that like, oh, therefore the Mises Caucus shouldn't exist or they shouldn't have these goals that they have. I can't swallow that pill. Like, to me, it's all about the fight and actually changing things. So I guess I don't knock people for doing the, you know, build your own life raft thing. And I also don't knock people for wanting to fight. I'm simply interested in the arguments that are being made. Like, do you want the Eye of Sauron following you? And what happens when MSNBC starts going through all the Legion of Skanks archives and pulls up every time Dave said a no word? And implicating everybody that's associated with the movement and everything. It's, again, it's not an anti LPMC argument that I'm making. It's just, it's something that we need to grapple with before this happens.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of Curtis Yarvin, I think he calls it the clear pill. And I honestly, I hate all the pills. I think red
there's
and blue
too are many pills.
The only ones that, pills. That need to be there. But, you know, I mean, that's kind of it. It's kind of like a black pill. I mean, it's like, you know, sit out. Like, you're not going to achieve power. Your people are not going to achieve power. So you might as well make the most of your life. And maybe once this system collapses, you will find yourself in a position of power. He gives the analogy, and I'm on Gray Mirror right now trying to find who he's talking about, and I can't find it. But I think it's the guy, he ended up being like the president of Czechoslovakia toward the end of the Soviet Empire. And you know, this guy was just a merchant, and he was a writer, and he was talking about how, you know, in 1970 or whatever it was, you were expected to put your Workers of the World Unite poster up in your window if you were a shopkeeper. It wasn't like, yeah, I support the workers of the world, let's unite. It's like, you get this poster in your box of potatoes or onions or whatever it is, and you put the sign up in the window, just like now with the Black Lives Matter or here in Minneapolis. Here in Minneapolis, you see a lot of black-owned business, and that's sort of like the lamb's blood on the Passover. Like, if there's a black-owned business, then the rioters and looters aren't supposed to hit it. Obviously, that's not always the case. We haven't had too much violence and looting in the last few months or so. Fingers crossed that won't pop up again. Although with police shootings going the way they are, I mean, you never know. it keeps happening here. Yeah, so this guy, he's a writer, and I wish I could fucking remember his name, but he was a writer, and then he ended up like the president of the Czech Republic following the collapse of the Soviet Union. And his secret was, don't get politically involved. And it ended up working really well for him. And I think that that's one of the Eastern European countries that is doing fairly well following the collapse.
Yeah. And I think it's sort of like the Warren Buffett thing, right? Like when he feels a recession coming on, like he sells his assets and sits on a bunch of cash. And then when it crashes, then you move in and you take control of all these things. And that's also something that I'm trying to reconcile, because I guess the sort of black-pilled libertarian take is that the empire is going to collapse due to hyperinflation and monetary recklessness and overexpanding our military. And it's like, okay, well, if we think that's coming, and right now the state is sort of like this wounded animal that's thrashing and they're going crazy, then why should we take them on when they're in that state and not after it collapses? Because to me, it seems like the reason I'm optimistic, or white pilled, as the kids say, even though we agree there's way too many pills, is when this thing crashes, like right now, we talked about this with Pete Quinones. Right now, we're already seeing people sort of voluntarily, organically, partake in federalism. People are voting with their feet. They're leaving California and going to Texas. And to me, it's like people are forming these like-minded communities and they're getting their legislation through. And there is sort of like the beginnings of a peaceful divorce happening. And it's not like we're trying to take control of the federal government. It's just that we're trying to have the right to be insulated from it. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, on that topic, I completely get that. Like, why not sit it out, or at least understand the argument of sitting it out? And then when the dust settles, then you have more control.
Yeah. No, and Nick, I totally agree with what you said about like how you want to root for the underdog. And, you know, I feel the same way, because this whole thing of even like publicly speaking on these issues, like, you don't know if this thing goes sideways in a few years and anyone who's associated with this movement might be a target, and me having a family and everything, that's stuff that I do lose sleep over. But at the same time, I feel compelled that if people like us sit quiet right now, then the game's already over. Everyone who has who passionately feels the way we feel, I think has an obligation at this point to step up and at least, you know, inspire other people to follow a certain route or get involved with what Dave is doing.
Yeah. And Mike, I mean, especially you with four kids, I mean, you have, I don't know, Nick, do you have kids? Are you
first one on the way?
Okay. So you guys have, you guys have a lot to lose. It's certainly something to consider. I mean, I've got a dog and a partner who, you know, I mean, if I end up in a gulag somewhere, then, you know, he'll find somebody else. You'll have kids. Like, that's real.
Yeah.
Not that my partner's not real. I hope he doesn't listen to this, but, you know, I mean, I'm not responsible for raising him and making him into a good person. Like, he's already a good person.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I completely get that. And I mean, that is like when I first went down the sort of Rothbardian rabbit hole 5 years ago, you know, I was like 20 years old, 21 years old. And, you know, I was like, I'm like, oh, this actually sounds cool. Like this Mad Max thing where we get to rebuild from scratch and bring it on. I'll buy some gold and silver and Bitcoin. And now that I've grown up a little bit and, you know, start to think about like family and the future and everything, it's actually it'll scare you shitless, the prospect of living in a collapsed society. And I know a lot of people will say like, well, look at the Soviet Union, you know, when they collapsed, it was the best thing that ever happened to Russia. And it's like, yeah, if you're going from Soviet Union standard of living and then you have like, you know, just basic black markets that are now like out in the open, then yeah, your standard of living will go up. But I think people too often don't realize how good we have it here. And it's like, things can get a lot worse really quickly. Yeah. And, you know, we like talk about like, you know, if you have Netflix and DoorDash, then you're basically content in this country. Like you don't care too much about this stuff.
You know, I was thinking today about like, if you look at the late 1960s, like how divided the country was over Vietnam and civil rights and everything. And then in the 70s, like you had like the oil embargo in like 73 and people were waiting in line to get gas. Like those people at that time had to think the world was coming to an end. You know, I mean, you had like Barry McGuire singing Eve of Destruction, like talking all about how like this has to be the end. And it got really bad for a long time. But then, like, if you look at the 80s, as far as America went, like, it was a time of peace and a lot more prosperity came. But the one thing I contrast with today's society that was a little different is, like, the indoctrination in the school districts and the, you know, the whole, like, big tech censorship. Like, that's a whole new element that we've never had to grapple with before that is kind of it. There's so many more powers at stake that are having impacts on our lives in every direction that we work on. I mean, we're on YouTube right now. We're using all these big platforms that can shut us down any minute. And that's the wild card that I'm really concerned about.
Yeah. I mean, that's why I've been really hammering this drum. Is that the beating this drum about the private companies? Like, and I know Pete has a much bigger platform than I do, and he's been hammering it even more than me, but this idea that Google, the owner of YouTube and Facebook and Twitter and all them, are private companies who can then therefore violate the rights of people, even though they are like completely beholden to and probably funded by the U.S. government. I mean, I can't mention the VACCINE on your podcast, or you guys are going to get delisted or demonetized or whatever by YouTube, because they are the propaganda arm of the state. This goes beyond like the press and the media and all that. Like, social media is the media now. And it's something that libertarians are going to need to contend with. It's something obviously that the entirety of society needs to contend with. How do we like get around this like digital tyranny, being that they aren't formally members of the state, but they are state actors?
Yeah. You know, this is one of the topics that, you know, months ago, we actually had Cyprian, formerly Vin Armani, on our podcast. And one of the things that like was a great analogy or great explanation to me is when he talked about how there will be no gulags, like we have digital gulags.
Yeah,
people get the debanking thing is really creepy to me, where PayPal refuses to process payments and like JP Morgan Chase will freeze somebody's credit card. And this whole thing is getting very bizarre. And just, you know, obviously banning people on YouTube. Remember when it was just Alex Jones like 4 years ago? And it's like, oh, Alex Jones got pulled off of YouTube. Like, this is unheard of that YouTube banned somebody. And then people are like, oh, who cares? It's just Alex Jones. You know, the guy's a wackadoodle. And then now it's like every day people are getting struck on YouTube and taken down. Yep. And you know, when it comes to the public-private thing, I think this is one of those libertarian dogmas that should be challenged, because it's like, okay, the New York Times is a private company. Your local fire department is government-owned. Okay, which one is the more moral institution that actually gives exactly a shit about you?
Yeah.
You know, it's right. Like, it's the fire department, man. Like, they're actually decent dudes that they get paid with tax money, but they're actually trying to protect their communities, right? This isn't even a decision. The New York Times, they're private, but, you know, they will push war propaganda and lead the millions of people to slaughter. So I think that is, like you mentioned, that's something that we need to get over and grapple with. And Pete has been really good on that. Mm-hmm. So yeah, this is another thing where this has to be part of the messaging, in my opinion.
And actually, not to toot my own horn, but I'm going to toot my own horn a little bit. I tweeted from the Libertarian Party of Minnesota's like official Twitter account the other day, something, I don't remember exactly what it was, but it was along these lines, calling, you know, Facebook or Twitter or whatever, not a private company. It might've even been the platform plank that we passed this year, saying that these state aligned organizations aren't private. Anyway, I tweeted it out and Tom Woods actually retweeted it. Like, even he's on board with this, and he has always been the, like, very much the, like he said, yeah, they're private companies, but that doesn't mean we can't like oppose them. We're you know, you don't go to a restaurant and get a shitty meal and say, oh, well, it's a private company. They can
serve exactly.
They give you raw chicken.
Exactly.
It's a great analogy for 2019, but like, you know, we have to come to this realization that these that these organizations are not private in the same sense that the restaurant, you know, getting bad Yelp reviews are private.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that is, and I think that is starting to pick up steam. I'm not sure who in the last, like, especially like you said, 2 years ago, I don't know who in the last 2 years that was in the sort of like libertarian scene, especially like the Mises circle. It seems like that idea is actually catching on, and people are starting to look at the cathedral, which is, I will forever be grateful to Yarvin for popularizing that term, because it really encapsulates like everything here. If people read Rothbard, it's like, oh, it's the state. Like the state is behind all of this with, you know, the professors and the university system. I think that awakening has been a really good thing. And I only hope that we can spread it to the rest of the population. So I guess pivoting from that a little bit, I briefly mentioned it earlier when Mike was coming in the chat room here, but I think that the goal of the Mises Caucus, we're not trying to win over leftists, right? If somebody's like a hardcore progressive, you know, wearing two masks everywhere, those aren't the people that we're going to harpoon and bring over. It's the people, and I've talked about this on the podcast a couple times as well, being able to inject our ideas into the lives of everyday, normies, that's actually going to move the needle and you know, popularize these ideas. And I think right now we're seeing inflation pick up, and this could be something that, if the Austrian School of Economics is right, this is going to become a much bigger issue in the coming years. And I think that libertarians, like, this is our time to shine. Like, this is what we obsess over. And when this happens, we need to have compelling, concise answers for people about why this is happening. Like, you know, I work in the plumbing industry. I work inside sales for a plumbing wholesaler, and people have been, whenever I give them an invoice, like, their eyes light up and they're looking at the price of copper and PVC and water heaters and all this stuff. And, you know, they make some comment about how the prices are through the roof. And I'm like, yeah, you know, you print $10 trillion in a year, and then, you know, shockingly, prices go up. And it seems like people are receptive to that. Like, people who are not interested in politics, they're like, oh yeah, no shit, it's going to be toilet paper by this time next year. Yeah. Like that kind of thing. So what do you think about the sort of broader strategy of the LPMC, like what it is and what it ought to be?
I think that's a big question, and it might be above my pay grade. I'm definitely more of the, let's debate libertarian philosophy till the sun comes up than I am. Let's talk about strategy. In fact, I told Michael Heiss, like, to his face, like, I will follow you anywhere. Just don't ask me to make plans for the caucus. I think if I'm going off the top of my head, like I said earlier, the local races is probably the best bet, as far as getting people elected and, creating that sort of air of legitimacy, for the party. And then just running absolutely no compromising or uncompromising libertarians on, you know, in bigger races where it makes sense to run uncompromising libertarians. Because again, man, don't fucking run a good libertarian against a, you know, 80% good Republican for governor of your state. Just don't do it. Like, there's too much at stake in 2021. That stuff made sense in 2016.
Yeah. You know,
it doesn't anymore.
You know, so Mike and I, we just did the Kelly Patrick show, that I think he just released the episode today. He does a lot of like libertarian politics, and he's actually like a regional MMA commentator. So we did his show, and it was a lot of fun. And I kind of like stumbled on this idea in my head. I'm like, wait, looking forward to 2024. What if it's a three-way race between Kamala Harris, Ron DeSantis, and Dave Smith? Like, I'm going to be telling everybody, like, listen to Dave Smith, but don't vote for him. Vote for Ron DeSantis, you know? Like,
well, and it probably depends on the state too. I mean, you know, Brian McClanahan was in 2016 saying, look, if you live in a red state, vote Gary Johnson. If you live in a blue state, vote Gary Johnson. If you live in a state where it might even be a little bit close, vote for Donald Trump. As an official member of the Libertarian Party of Minnesota's executive committee, I'm not going to give anybody that advice, but, you know, you really might want to consider Brian McClanahan's advice if it comes to that in 2024. you know, I have the benefit of living in a hard blue state. I mean, we're the only state that voted for Walter Mondale, for God's sake. So I don't have that moral conundrum. Yeah, I mean, I think the LP needs to run a presidential candidate because that's how we get publicity on the like national stage. But man, who should the average Joe vote for? I mean, look, if it's DeSantis versus Kamala, DeSantis is going to win. Kamala is horribly unpopular. But whichever one of them wins, there's going to be lots and lots of global bloodshed. Like neither one of those people is a good candidate. It just so happens that DeSantis was real good on COVID. He's terrible on everything else.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think he, like you said, he's not good. I know a lot of the libertarian criticisms of him have been like, well, he's like a super Zionist. And it's like, yeah. Okay, as opposed to what every other president of our lifetime, yeah, you know?
Exactly.
So it's like, okay, at least he's better domestically. He did things like ban vaccine passports and he's banning CRT in schools and all of these things. And he was anti-lockdown. And to me,
for the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
It's like, okay, I'm like being anti-war is one of my strongest positions as much as, you know, the next libertarian, but how are we supposed to have any impact on the rest of the world and tackling like US foreign policy if we're being locked in our homes? Like if we can't even win that battle, then how are we going to change anything else? So like you said, I'm sympathetic to the idea of voting for the Republican, even if they're not perfect, if it actually has a chance of swinging the race. But I like, you know, I said before, I also want to see Dave get on a debate stage. That's not going to happen. I just like gut feeling, the gut meter tells me that Dave is not going to be on CNN, like debating Kamala Harris. It would be the most glorious thing that mankind has ever witnessed. I just don't think it's going to happen.
Dave's benefit is that he has a resume full of cable news appearances and those won't slow down if he runs for president. You know, I mean, sure, he's not going to be featured on like MSNBC, but he wouldn't be anyway.
Right. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And like people like Rogan would have like an obligation to have mine. Yeah. It'd be so blatant if he stopped having Dave Smith on while he's running. It'd be like, it would be like you completely turn your back on the guy. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's funny that you mentioned that like you're fortunate enough to live in a deep blue state. And Nick and I are in Illinois too. So I said the same thing on the Kelly Patrick show that. If Dave is, I don't care what percent Dave is at, I'm going to vote for him in Illinois because it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Damn, I didn't know y'all were in Illinois. That's awesome. We're going to have to have like a Midwest, because I was just talking to LB Muniz the other day. We need to have like a Midwest little meetup.
For sure, dude. And I get up to the Twin Cities a couple times a year for purposes. So yeah.
Nice. Yeah. Let me know next time you're here.
For sure.
Because we do like almost, I don't know, at least monthly stuff.
Cool. Probably. Where about are you at in the Twin Cities?
I'm right in the middle of Minneapolis.
Okay, cool.
Oh, sweet. But, look at that. I thought I'd heard you mention that you're in Minnesota before. So, I never even considered that. There's a very similar dynamic with like your local state politics as with us. And what sucks about us is there like one city in Minnesota that like dominates the rest? Is it like Minneapolis is blue and everybody else is kind of conservative?
Minneapolis and St. Paul are very blue. Duluth is up near Lake Superior is purplish. And then everything else is red.
Yeah, that's how it is with us. I mean, we grew up, an hour west of Chicago, kind of out in farm country. And like everywhere around here is people are just kind of like small town conservatives. But all of our politics are run by Chicago.
But yeah, exactly. But the cool thing about Minnesota is that the Republicans tend to be libertarian leaning. And in fact, I think in 2012, Rick Santorum like won our popular caucus vote, whatever, for the GOP primaries. Mm-hmm. But then at convention, we sent like our entire delegation was Ron Paul. Except one Ron Paul delegate gave up his seat so that Michelle Bachmann, the congresswoman, could go as a delegate because she wasn't running for Congress again that year. So just like out of respect for her. But other than that, it was unanimously Ron Paul. Like, it's just, I mean, it's a blue state, but it's fairly independent. I think we were the first Democrat governor, like state with a Democrat governor who lifted the lockdowns, which, you know, I mean, he lifted the lockdowns because people were rioting over George Floyd's murder.
Right.
But, you know, I mean, he lifted the lockdowns and he took the mask mandate away as soon as the CDC lifted theirs. Like we didn't drag it out forever. In fact, he had a date set and then the CDC announced, if you're vaccinated, you can take off your mask, which, you know, nobody listened to.
Yeah.
And so he was like, oh man, well, we've always said we're going to follow the science. So I guess take off your mask if you're vaccinated, like that day. So, you know, kudos to our governor. I would much rather have a governor who didn't lock us down, but, you know, ours has been okay. And our state has a pretty good culture of individualism, minus the George Floyd riots, which.
So how's the culture been in the Twin Cities? Cause the people I know up there, that I associate with, I know a couple of people I know are very politically aligned with myself, but they said they were like, they and their friends were boycotting, kind of even going to Twin games. And they're like, they were diehard lifelong Twin fans. They're so upset with the actual city, after all that. Do you see a lot of that in your experience?
Well, okay. My partner's parents live in South Minneapolis in the precinct that was burned down. That police station is still not staffed. They don't have cops. And there is apparently an arson situation going on. Wow. His dad's van, which is his work van, like it's his source of income, was just torched the night before the 4th of July. And there's houses and other like fires just being set. So yes, there, and obviously, I mean, there's a crime wave going on in like every major city. It's happening in Minneapolis too. There's carjackings and murders and all kinds of stuff. So I'm like, for the very first time in my life, a little bit scared to go out at night, which I don't like. I don't like that feeling. On the other hand, like me and my friends, you know, we love it here. Like this is home. This is, like I've gone to Twins games and stuff. I'm not boycotting anything. Well, no, that's not true. There are a couple of restaurants that are still mandating masks and I'm boycotting those. Cause I'm not going to fucking wear a mask
for you.
But, yeah.
Thank you.
I mean, it's just dumb. Other than that, you know, I mean, it's home. That how do you talk shit about your home? You know what I mean?
Well, step one is be from Illinois, and then that will come pretty easily.
Good point.
Yeah, but no, I mean, it's an interesting point you bring up. I didn't even consider that you were really at like ground zero during the riots last year.
Well, here's the thing. I was in Dallas.
Oh, really?
Oh, okay.
So I grew up in Dallas. My family lives there. I've been here for over a decade. So this is, like I said, home. But we happened to be in Dallas over Memorial Day weekend. So we had to watch everything over Facebook live streams, which actually got us a front row seat because, you know, being members of the LGBTQ community or whatever, like all of our friends were out, like they were out in the protests and riots. And a lot of them were the ones distributing, you know, milk and water to people and being good Samaritans. I have a paramedic friend who was, you know, literally cleaning up the next day and helping people who were in need of medical assistance. But one guy who's like a friend of a friend of a friend, was live streaming from the very front lines. They were, when they were storming that police station and stuff. And to be honest, I was pretty giddy at the time. Like I loved seeing the police station get torched, seeing the aftermath of it and not being a particularly long-term thinker. I kind of regret being so giddy, but you know, I mean, at the time it was pretty exciting. I felt like I was witnessing something.
Yeah, yeah, well, I mean, there's kind of like a feeling like it had something to do with the lockdowns. Like it was people were fed up with being state controlled. Yeah. But then it got turned black versus white really quick. And I was like, whoa, no, this is like us, like top versus, you know, us bottom feeders. But I got sent up there for work a week after the riots. And it was crazy. So it was like all just the rubbish. Like I went there and there's like boarded up windows, graffiti, Justice for George, spray painted on the streets and sidewalks. Yeah. And it was crazy. And like, I had to go to a hotel and I can't remember what street I was on, but I could see the Minnesota Wild Stadium from my hotel. So I was right downtown. And I remember asking the lady at the hotel when I was checking in, because we were like the only people there. I was like, you guys don't get a lot of traffic during riot season? And she's like, no.
Oh, my God.
It's been exceptionally slow this week. But I was terrified. I was there with a couple of coworkers, and I was like, you know, going out at night was kind of like, oh, boy, is this like we don't know what to expect. But it was pretty peaceful, you know, from where I was sitting, at least. But
I mean, see like the videos of when you're talking about that shift in your gut feeling. When you started to see videos of like bar owners who were watching their businesses get vandalized, and they went out there to try to defend it and like, you know, talk to the crowd, and they were getting kicked by four people, and you see somebody who looks like he's dead, like their arms are bent backwards and they're unconscious on the ground. You see old couples that get smacked with 2x4s. It got really dark pretty quickly. And I guess this is a good segue into the one topic that I wanted to start with tonight. We ended up not starting with it, but this is something that a lot of people have been talking about. Like, I know Buck Johnson has been, first of all, I really like Buck's podcast. He's a great interviewer and just a fun guy to listen to. But he's been kind of pushing this idea that libertarianism is inherently right wing. And I guess, like, first starting with this discussion, you have to, I guess, define your terms here. So I guess, like, I always thought that, like, I grew up conservative, so I identified as right. And then I became like a hardcore libertarian. I'm like, okay, so I'm neither left nor right. Like, I would kind of describe myself that way to people. And then where it's really shifted has been the last year and a half, where, like, we're talking about with the riots and everything. And you look at states that are red and communities that are red, and they were unanimously, you know, condemning these riots and all of the lockdowns and everything. And you see the left, like, you know, not only cheering those on, but then just like also they're all for lockdowns and mandating masks and everything. Yeah. And it's like, just on a very like reality based level, we have to admit that we are more aligned with the right. And maybe you could say that, yeah, sure, as individuals, we tend to overlap more with the right in 2021. But I guess you could make the case that the ideology of libertarianism being like non-aggression isn't left or right. But then I don't know if it was Yarvin. I was trying to remember who said this. He basically defined right wing as the absence of progressivism or the absence of being left wing. Like, if you're not left, you are right by default. So like left wing is like this force feeding of ideas that's like pushing the needle forward and trying to change society. So if you're a reactionary against that, it makes you right wing. Like, what are your thoughts on that idea?
Yeah. So I think that's part of the problem with trying to define us as left, right, or neither, is you can't really define it. Like Popular Liberty, Andrew has said that the left has a high time preference for power and the right has a low time preference for power. That's how he defines it. I think probably the most convincing definition of left and right has to do with hierarchy. The left is skeptical of hierarchy, where the right feels like hierarchy is both inevitable and desired. I don't like to take a firm position on that because the terms are so nebulous.
Yes.
As to be undefinable. I think that if I had to define myself, regardless of which definition you pick, I fall pretty firmly on the left. I'm not a Marxist, but I certainly understand the appeal of like class struggle and the appeal of at least local communism. Obviously, national communism gets extremely problematic, but you know, it would not be outside of my comfort zone to live on a commune. Like I said earlier, I'm much more the type to sit and talk philosophy for hours. So like Bernie Sanders, I'd probably get kicked off of any commune I joined. But, you know, I mean, it's not an unattractive scenario for me.
When you say commune, are you like referring to like a voluntary private or? Yeah. Okay. So absolutely. Like that's
so, but I also like the malice test, you know, are some people better than others? I definitely give you a speech. I don't say yes or no. The hierarchy test. I'm definitely skeptical of hierarchy, even voluntary hierarchies. I think I agree with using that particular definition of rightism. I think I agree with the right that hierarchies are inevitable, but I agree with the left that they're not necessarily desirable.
So, I see why you say that you are the kind of philosophy type to you know, talk these things until the sun rises, because it makes sense, because you are somewhat of a unicorn in this space, like being in the Mises circle. Thanks. And you're in like the Misesian world, but also kind of identify on the left and talk about like the values you just laid out. And I mean, to an extent, like I would probably identify myself as like right libertarian, or even I feel like it's kind of a loaded term, but like paleo libertarian. I'm not sure how accurate that would be, but you know, in general, like I do like embracing hierarchies in certain contexts, but also I find myself very sympathetic to a lot of left wing impulses. Mm-hmm. Like I don't like seeing like rampant inequality. It's just that with income inequality and people that are in poverty, my recipe for fixing that is going to be like free market economics and like Bitcoin and competing currencies. Yeah. But I still like, and like, I want to see people be treated equally, you know? And I think the best way to have like people in marginalized groups treated equally is to have like voluntary transactions, that we need to remove the state from interfering in all these things. So I completely get that. Like, and then I guess with the, are some people better than others question, I would just say yes. You know, it's like, to me, it's like, yeah. But I get the argument of like why you want to elaborate and pull apart the nuance there. Sure. So I think that is, I think that is interesting. So, yeah. I mean, on the topic, sorry, go ahead.
Well, and just, for like a little added color, like this whole trend of libertarians and, you know, other people of goodwill converting all of a sudden to Orthodox Christianity. I completely understand the allure to going back to these traditional like apostolic versions of Christianity from the either Roman Catholicism that I was raised in, or the evangelicalism that a lot of our Protestant friends were raised in. This need for a like central guiding tradition that goes back 2,000 years. Oh my God, that I understand why that is so powerfully attractive to people. But I also understand why, like my friends who go by they, them pronouns, and my new coworker who like just came out as transgender a few months ago, and she hasn't even shaved off her beard yet and still wants us to call her. Like, I totally get that too. So I feel like I'm kind of caught between two different realities.
Yeah. And, you know, with things like that, like let's say with your coworker, like, I guess this is also another, I would say like, I have like a left-wing sympathy or like instinct or whatever, is like, I'm generally a non-confrontational person. I don't like, I really don't like offending people. You know, it's like, I think that I'm, you know, people that want to like forcefully vaccinate kids against their will, like I'm all for insulting them all day long, call them whatever is going to hurt their feelings. But in general, it's like, I don't want to offend people. That makes me feel like bad when somebody gets upset by something I say. So I completely get that. To me, it's the creepy thing that we're seeing is like, when you see like corporations and banks get behind like all of these weird, like they're like psyops, you know, these PR campaigns that we see, like when you watch the Super Bowl, it's like every single commercial is woke. It's just like
that fucking CIA ad, man.
Yeah. Oh my God. That's the perfect illustration.
Yeah.
It's the perfect illustration. And I feel like, and okay, this is where I put on my tinfoil hat. I feel like it's almost, you know, targeted campaign to divide and conquer. Like, you're taking people that like, let's look at the right wing in the last, 10, 15 years, like they have come a long way on a lot of social issues. Like they really have, like they're even like establishment Republican voters are very live and let live, you know? And it's like,
go ahead. Sorry.
I was going to say, it's like the idea of, you know, we want to be an inclusive society and you know, tolerant of others. It's like, guys, that battle's pretty much won. Like if somebody is like, you know, openly bigoted or racist or whatever. It's like, even if there's a right wing or a company that's like owned by conservatives, they're going to like fire that person immediately. Like, it's just the way our society's moved. And, you know, Gavin McInnes always uses this phrase where he's like, you guys are fighting ghosts. And I think that's a lot of what we're seeing right now is people, like, if you look at the whole like BLM movement, you know, they're acting as if we still live in the Jim Crow South and not appreciating how far our society's come. And I really like this analogy of progressivism being like a fruit. Like, if it's a banana, if you have a society with no progress, it's like a green banana that you can't eat. Like, it's not ready to eat yet. Mm-hmm. But if you have so much progressivism, it's like, okay, the banana's turning brown and there's fruit flies around it, you know?
That's a good analogy. Yeah.
Yeah. I can't remember where I heard it. I might have come up with it. So I'll throw that out there.
If you did. I think, and actually this is, I haven't like done a ton of thinking about this. I think that progressivism as like an ideology is the antithesis and opposite of libertarianism as an ideology. And yes. I think that you have left libertarians just like you have left progressives, but you also have right progressive just like you have right libertarians. I think that the like common thread of progressivism is just this idea that the government can accomplish all of these things that the progressives want the government to accomplish.
Yeah, even going back to
libertarianism is the opposite of that.
Yeah, like, and I feel like the word progressive is fitting if you go back to like Teddy Roosevelt and how he wanted the government to be like this agency of manufacturing like global good.
Yeah.
So I feel like that tradition of progressivism has really stayed true to itself, and it's dominated the last 100 years. And meanwhile, conservatism, and this is maybe a chat for another time, because I wanted to talk like political labels tonight, because it seems like those are ever evolving and shifting and changing. And, you know, if you listen, so I like Dave Rubin. I really like listening to his show, but it gets a little old. He asks every single guest.
Oh, my God.
He asks every guest. Would you make any distinction between classical liberal and libertarian? And it's like, come on, Dave, like there's so much more beyond that. Like, yeah, they're pretty much the same thing. All right. Can we move on? Like, I want to know about
such
like
a boomer con.
I know, man. It's a bummer.
I used to love him so much.
I know.
He started calling people patriots, which like, okay, fine. Yeah. Call people patriots. But you're right. I mean, like all of that just sort of nonsense is just such window dressing when you have deeper issues to discuss.
Yeah. And I know we actually talked about this on some Facebook posts. I can't remember what group it was in, but yeah, Dave Rubin, it's like, it's a tough one because I feel like he has one foot in the sort of like real, you know, alternative media scene. And then he's also trying to like pander to boomer cons, where if you just look at his episode titles, it's just all these, like, you won't believe Biden said this in all caps. And it's like, okay, I get it. You're going for the clicks for like the you know, former Fox News viewers who are now like disenchanted.
Yeah,
I get it. But yeah, no, it's tough because I still like him a lot. You know, I like listening to his show. He's a great interviewer. But gosh, that's been rough to see his cringe BoomerCon transformation.
But on the other hand, his interview style is something that I want to mimic and like model myself after.
Absolutely.
Like, I love the way that he asks questions and stuff. And
yeah,
that is like my crowning achievement as a podcaster is my interviews. Like I've been called like the perfect interviewer, which I love.
That's how I discovered you, is your interview of Tom Woods.
Okay.
And then I recognized your name from were you in the Part of the Problem inner circle?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. That's so I knew you from there. I thought so. And then, like the LPMC, but, your interviewing style is great. And, I think that, you know, Dave Rubin is also a great architect of interviewing. So let me see, before
Daniel
we get out
question
of here
in the chat too.
Yes. I was about to say, so before we get out of here, we should, okay, go ahead and answer the question.
Okay. So Daniel W, who is a friend of mine, shout out to Daniel W, whose last name I'm not going to say, even though I finally know how to pronounce it after all these years of interacting online. He says, do you guys think that any organization that is not explicitly right wing will become left wing, applies to the Mises Caucus? And I think that the Mises Caucus is explicitly right wing. I mean, I don't know. It really depends on how you define the terms. That's the problem.
Yeah. Because I mean,
so here's the Mises Caucus. And this is one area where I differ from the Mises Caucus. They're very, very hardcore on the Lockean understanding of private property. And that is like the quintessential right-wing position. So I don't think that that's something that the Mises Caucus has to worry about. I'm happy to be affiliated with them and associated with them because I think that other than the few areas where I disagree with them as a political movement, are the areas also that will lend stability to them as a political movement, including Lockean property rights.
Yeah, yeah. First of all, I like that thought experiment of any organization that's not explicitly right wing becoming left wing. I think that it's something to definitely be weary of. But when you, like you mentioned, it's so the devil's in the details of like defining your terms, because like you described yourself as you know, left wing. I describe myself as sort of to the right.
I don't describe myself as left wing.
Sure, sure.
But all the tests that you take,
yes,
I fall on the left.
Right, right. So if somebody listened to you, like, you know, kind of flesh out your philosophy, they might go, oh, that guy seems like a left winger if I had to like check a box left or right. But, you know, and you made the case, and I respect the case you laid out why you might identify that way or say that you're in that camp. But at the same time, if I just like look at all your politics, like your policies in a box, I'd be like, yep, that guy's on my team. He's on the libertarian right, you know?
I'm definitely anti-woke, or whatever we're calling woke nowadays, since that term has fallen out of vogue.
Yeah.
Except for the boomer cons.
Right, right. And this is what the progressive left is so good at, is playing the language game. And then when something gets a bad rap, they scrap it and they move on to a new term. So I mean, I don't know what's going to replace woke, if it's just like, I don't know, whatever the next thing is. And then you see, like, right now they're running from the term critical race theory, where they go, I'm not a critical race theorist. You know, that's a legal structure. I'm just an admirer and somebody who thinks that this should be discussed.
You think we shouldn't teach kids about slavery? Oh man. Come on, dude.
Like, we never learned about slavery, right? We never learned about it.
Even when we came up in school. How old are you, James, if you don't mind me asking?
I'm 38. I'm way older than you. And we learned, and I'm from Texas. Like, I'm from the, you know, the dirty South or whatever, the last bastion of slavery. And not only did we learn about slavery, but we learned about Juneteenth. While y'all were like up here never hearing of this new federal holiday, like, I was raised celebrating it.
Like, right.
You know, I mean,
so that's what's so frustrating. So it's not even that, like, oh, kids are already learning about slavery now. It's like, no, they have been since slavery was a thing.
Yeah,
you know,
that's not what's at issue here.
Right. And for the last 100 years, I think you'd struggle to find a teacher who was like known for saying, like, making a moral defense of slavery. It's like, it's such a nonsense, like, straw man argument. To try to say, like, this is just about racial sensitivity. And when Trump was on the debate stage with Biden, and Trump's like, critical race theory is bad. It's very bad. All kinds of bad things are going to come from it. And then Biden's like, hey, we're just teaching kids to be race inclusive and sensitive about race. Why is that a bad thing? And Trump didn't have a defense, because Trump was the kid who, you know, didn't really read the book, but does the book report anyway and gives the speech. So a lot of people just kind of, that was their only exposure to it. And it's like, it's just a new form of racial sensitivity. So it's frustrating. Like, the left, they are like, you have to admire the sort of gymnastics they pull with language.
If I can quote, and I'm going to call it right now, if I can quote the next president of these United States, comic Dave Smith, from a tweet earlier today, and this is it resonates with me so much. The most powerful voices are always the ones that shatter the paradigm, and I love that, first of all, because, you know, the paradigm is like not even like the conventional wisdom. It is what everyone just assumes to be true. It's the era that we live in. So the most powerful voices are always the ones that shatter the paradigm. The black parents passionately opposing schools teaching their children that they are victims are some of the most important voices in the country. And that is absolutely true. I don't care where I fall, on the left or right. If you're teaching little kids that either they are victims who are, you know, unable to rise above their victimhood, or oppressors who are unable to repent of their oppressiveness, you are not only abusing the kids, but you're destroying the future society. Like, you guys as parents, like, have a huge responsibility there. And it just, it breaks my heart that that's even a thing that is being considered, that these teachers unions are like, I mean, who are they in it for? Why would you become a teacher if you wanted to tell kids that?
I know, it's the most disempowering thing you could tell somebody. If you just like took, like, forget the world of politics for a minute. If you had a friend or a kid that you knew in your life that like had this kind of woe is me attitude, that thought they didn't have a chance because everybody was out to get them, you'd be like you'd be say, you know, snap out of it. Like, you have the power to like change your circumstances. You know, this whole notion of like teaching kids that they're victims, like you said, it's just, it's awful. It's one of the worst things you can do. And before we move on, that tweet that you quoted from Dave about the most powerful voices being the one that shatter the paradigms, I loved one of the replies to that. He goes like, you know, black parents who speak out against the schools, you know, anti-war veterans. And this one guy just comments, he's like, "Wiggers that use the N-word." And I just thought that was hilarious. Like, it was just this nonsense. Like,
this is one of those GFY shit posters who, of course, I'm following. Right. I don't even know who this is. I hate that so much. I'm following all these people who like, are going to destroy my political career, which is never going to happen. But like, if someone were to go through my Twitter followings, I follow like 4,000 people. It's insane. But man,
The TLE guys are not cut out for office.
No. And it's like, I just, I'm a sucker for a well-timed joke that's like on a serious post, like something that's just nonsense. Like, I love it. It's just, I couldn't let that go. It was too funny. Well,
but back is this to your actually point, a Timeline Earth guy? Who is this?
I don't know. I think I know a lot of
him. I saw a TLE tag. He might just be a fan.
I know. Yeah. He's got a Blue Chew label for his profile. Book, so that tells you a lot.
But back to your teacher thing. I know we had Dr. Stephen Hicks on our show a few weeks ago, and he talked about when these teachers
graduate. Is he the postmodernism guy?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, he ironically lives in Rockford, Illinois. He's like, he's 20 minutes away from me.
Of course, I'm a huge fan of, and like literally am on the payroll of Thad Russell. So that tells you like where I fall on the Stephen Hicks versus postmodernism debate too.
We got a comment confirming that was Aaron from Timeline Earth that made that comment.
Oh, okay.
I knew he was GFY.
GFY is go fuck yourself, by the way. He told us when he was on here.
I was the GFY HR manager for a time. I'm not good at shit posting at all, so it just didn't work. But you know, it was fun. It was fun for the week or so that I had it on Twitter.
Yeah, but yeah. Anyway. So Dr. Hicks ironically lives like 20 minutes from Nick and I. He lives like right next to us. Kind of cool. But he said when the teachers graduate from their teacher school and you know college, get their degree, they sign an oath to uphold like these 10 principles, and they keep changing them, and it's more and more.
Seriously?
Mm-hmm. And basically, some of them just sign it, and then some of them feel guilty if they're not doing it, and just want to help kids, and you know they either do or do not abide by it. And then some feel like they sign an oath, they got to uphold it, and it becomes their religion. And yeah, it's kind
playing
of
on people's sense of honor.
Wow.
Yeah.
You know, that's oath is the like anglicized version or like the English translation of the word sacrament. Like when we talk about oaths, that has a much deeper meaning than just like a promise or a contract or whatever. This is actually something serious. Like, it's baptism. It's the Eucharist. It's, you know, these things that have like actual real religious value.
VACCINE.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Whoa, dude, you're not kidding. Talk about a modern sacrament.
It's a baptism.
Or not modern, maybe like a postmodern sacrament, really. These little rituals and these little promises that we make and these oaths that we take and stuff, like, we have to be really cognizant of what we're doing. We're not just making a promise. It's like, this is real. This is like, if you believe in the soul or not, this is soul binding stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. And dude, that's no joke. And I think that's something that people feel on a very like spiritual level, where if you ask somebody, like if you tell a white lie, right? Like if my wife says like, "Oh, did you remember to take out the garbage or something?" And I go, I'm like, yeah, I did. And it's like, okay, I'll really go do it in a minute. And she's like, swear on Sophie, our dog's life. And I'll be like, no, I'll go do it right now. Like there's this, there's this another level of like, this is my honor. Yeah. Like, this is my soul, like you said. And I think that that whole oath thing like really plays into that. But, hey guys, so I do have sort of a hard out. I wanted to wrap up by around nine. Okay. Even though we could talk for hours. James, plug your podcast, your Twitter, everything that you want to plug, people can find you.
Podcast is at blackbird.substack.com and Twitter is at @JamesLJ.
Well, James, thanks so much. I wish we could talk a little more. Next time in the Twin Cities, I'll hit you up though.
Quite
a bit. So, guys, please rate, review our show, leave us a review on iTunes, and find us at Freedom Fest, July 21st or 24th in Rapid City. So,
and Paul's to the Walls on Twitter with a Z at the end.
Can I shout out real quick Bobby Joe in the chat? She's
been I wanted to.
Super active, and I love her to death. And I'm going to give her a big hug next time I'm in St. Paul. And we didn't get to acknowledge any of the stuff that she contributed to.
I felt bad because I'm like, I love the live commenters, but it's like,
no, she's new to us. We're learning.
Catch up.
Oh, yeah, she's so great. Hopefully she'll come back. But she's awesome. And if next time we do like a Twin Cities meetup, she'll definitely be there too.
Hell yeah.
All right, cool. Talk to you guys later. Thank you so much.
Thanks, James, guys. Thanks for listening.
Bye.
Bye.
Without the ones like you who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.